I'm Rita Wheeler. I am the leader of today's session on living with the handicapped. And I'm here in part as a professional, as Herman Greer pointed out, in part because I have experienced life with a handicapped person. My ex-husband has multiple sclerosis, and I'll tell you more about that later. For now, let's begin with just a brief moment of prayer. Lord, we just thank you for our bodies, whatever they may be. We thank you that in you there is a stronghold, Lord, stronger than our bodies may ever be, or surely maybe at some time in the future. We thank you, Lord, for the gift of seeing, of hearing, of feeling, of touching. And we pray, Lord, for growing compassion for those who may not experience the world in the way that we do. First of all, let me tell you a little about my childhood, and I think that sets the stage for where I am today and why I'm here at Holden. Can we make the circle just a little larger and include
it? Sorry, I'm late.
Beating my face. I was born and raised in Montana. I still live in Montana. I grew up on a farm. My parents are grain farmers there. And I grew up in a little Methodist church, which, for those of you who are sort of theologically oriented, means that it was probably a pretty works-oriented kind of thing. And, of course, the roots of the Methodist church are sort of grounded in social activism, that your faith manifests itself in what you do. And I really think that, I think it was like Luther, I came kicking and screaming into the kingdom of God, at least into Lutheranism, and felt that many times what I saw was Lutheran theology that was taking place in four walls and never seemed to get beyond that very much. And yet I found Holden Village to be at least one example of how faith, teaching people that their faith in fact does go beyond that. And I think one of the last places that it is going is to the handicapped, that we don't always, as Christians or as Lutheran Christians, reach out to the handicapped the way that we could or might. And I think that just some signs that I've seen here that are really encouraging to me. When I first came with my husband and daughter in 1981, there were no ramps. In fact, in 1983, there were no wheelchair ramps or anything else here. And the modifications that had been made in the environment here were really pretty limited. At any rate, I'm really pleased to see that, and I'm glad to be able to bring to you some thoughts about what I have learned over the years, both as the wife of a handicapped person and as a professional working with parents of handicapped children. For those of you who don't know what multiple sclerosis is, it's a disease that, for whatever reason, in young adulthood, usually begins to attack the myelin sheath around the nerves. And the nerve, the electrical impulse of the nerve then is sent off in all kinds of crazy directions, just the way that an electrical wire that isn't insulated would do. And consequently, any incoming messages, it could be auditory messages for hearing, visual messages. My husband lost his sight in the beginning, and that was how it was diagnosed. Or outgoing messages to the nerves to make your muscles do things can be lost in the transmittal. And so MS takes all kinds of strange directions. There is no prognosis that they can really give you when they finally determine that you have multiple sclerosis. And some people will go decades and really barely know they have it. And other people within 2 weeks can be bedridden and never get up. My husband was somewhere in the middle. He is now in a wheelchair and has problems with speech. And his sight returned. These are some of the mysteries they don't understand particularly about multiple sclerosis. But his vision did come back. And so, truly, it meant a walk of faith for us day by day. I didn't know what he could do and what he couldn't do, and he frequently couldn't tell me. or didn't tell me, I don't know which. Professionally, before I got to that point, I had taught school and I had had experiences with normal children, quote, quote, in classrooms. But this was before federal law had mandated services to all handicapped children. And so what was a normal child was a fairly broad range, including a lot of children that we would now consider handicapped under what's known as Public Law 94-142, the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. And yet there were a number of children, we didn't see severely profoundly handicapped children because they were tucked away in institutions where no one had to look and see and experience them because it was a lot more comfortable for us all that way. In Montana, like many other states, our state institution for the severely handicapped, the developmentally disabled, is off in a little town that the only reason the town exists is because it has an institution. And our institution for the hearing impaired was off away from the city on a nice little neat campus of its own, and it still is. And unfortunately, we're still sending children there, even though many of them would be dealt with appropriately in a city of 100,000 like Billings is. That's where I live. At any rate, when my husband's MS was diagnosed, our families, his and mine, decided that I should go back to school, and I did that. I ended up with a master's degree in special education. It was in educationally handicapped, which is learning disabled and emotionally disturbed, and is sort of a far cry from where I've actually been working, which is with the severely and profoundly developmentally disabled. I've also had the experience of alcohol addiction in a family, which is, I think, a handicapping sort of experience for a family, or at least it certainly has a lot of similarities. I seem to have encountered in my life a number of people who have been handicapped, and I'm not sure if this is the Lord's calling for me or not, but I certainly end up in that position, it seems, over and over again, although I hadn't really planned this for my life in any way. I did not get into my profession because of my husband's disability, however, and probably had I been able to foresee the future, I might have even set myself in other directions, I don't know, or I would have hoped the Lord would have pulled me somewhere else, I guess. But I do think that I was led to do the things that I have done, and that my experience in our family probably has made me better in my field, because I know what parents are telling me when they talk about the pain of having a handicapped child. So at any rate, when my husband was in graduate school, and this was like 4 years after our marriage, we had rededicated our lives to Christ in the interim, and he had decided to go back to graduate school and get a master's degree, and he lost his vision. He had given blood in November, like the 5th of November, and he kept wiping his glasses, thinking there was a spot on them, and the spot kept getting bigger, and he realized it wasn't his glasses at all, so he went to the Student Health Center, and they said, well, there's something wrong, but we don't know what it is. And so they sent him to an ophthalmologist. And at that point, then half of his vision in his right eye was gone. And they said, we don't know what it is. Come back in a week. And by then, half of his vision in both eyes was gone. And it was because you read from left to right, he kept reading into the blind spot. And eventually, they sent us to the University of Utah at Salt Lake, which was the only place, or the closest place that there was a CAT scan at that time, and I don't know what that stands for, but it's this thing. You can probably tell them that takes x-rays of brains. And they thought perhaps that he had a brain tumor. And I think in one sense we might have been able to live with that diagnosis a little easier, because what they come back with MS is, well, we don't know, we have eliminated these things, and possibly it's MS, and to this day, that's the only diagnosis we have, although it feels pretty comfortable not to call it MS. But at any rate, then his vision returned, and he continued with his graduate studies, and I did get my master's degree, and I worked for 2 years then in an early childhood program, a model program, serving developmentally disabled children, and then at his suggestion, actually, applied for the directorship of the organization that I work for now. It's called Special Training for Exceptional People, or STEP. And our mission is to provide support services to families of handicapped children and to assist them with maintaining their child at home as opposed to institutionalizing their child. And when that no longer is a possibility, to find foster homes for children. And when that's not even a good possibility, we have a child that's so handicapped that they destroy foster homes over and over again, then to look to a group home situation for them. And we operate two group homes for children, four children in each home in Billings. Beyond me, beyond our organization, there is a whole system in Montana of services to the developmentally disabled. And they include everything from sheltered workshops for children graduating from special education in high school where they have sheltered employment. And the step beyond that is vocational placement, where they go out into a regular competitive job and for a relatively long period of time that we don't define, it's based on the needs of the individual, then there's someone who goes with them and does the job in the beginning for them and gradually trains them, shapes their behavior to let them do the job themselves, teaches them appropriate behavior at coffee break time, how to get along with their employees in social situations as well. And so there are all kinds of services in the vocational spectrum, and then in the residential spectrum, after our services are ended at an age at which the normal child would leave home, about 18. And we have different kinds of group homes in Montana, some serving very severely handicapped individuals, either behaviorally disordered or very skill deficient. In a, they can't dress themselves or feed themselves, perhaps. And then there are group homes for higher functioning individuals that do most of the work, but eight of them will live together under the supervision of counselors. Beyond that, there's a transitional living program where they have their own apartments, but there is somebody on site all the time. And the next step beyond that is that they have their own apartments, but there's somebody only on call. And then finally, we're real limited in this area, but some follow-along services to people who are actually independent, living on their own, but may need help at the point at which the bank tells them that their checkbook doesn't balance or, you know, something like that. So one of the things I'll be talking today about is that I think that there have to be lots and lots of options, and that we have been too quick to say what it is that the handicapped need, and we haven't always listened to what they said they needed. I asked Jim the other day, I said, you know, if I were to ask you the question, what it is that you would need in to be a part of a family, and I was talking in that sense about both the nuclear family and then the larger societal family, what would you say? And he said, well, that we are people first. And I think that, for instance, my husband and the families that we work with, so many times people treat the handicapped as if they don't exist, sort of. They treat them as if they are not there, even though they are physically present. And so when the waitress comes up to a couple, and one of them is in a wheelchair, she will ask the mobile ambulatory person what the person sitting in the wheelchair wants. Well, my husband knew perfectly well what he wanted, and certainly I consider myself a Christian feminist, which to me means that we are all striving to be all that God meant us to be, and that includes the handicapped. And I really didn't ever like him ordering for me at the restaurant, and I chose not to order for him as he made the transition to becoming more and more disabled. And yet I saw people treating him very differently over that period of time. And so I think that's one thing that we really need to be cognizant of, is that they are people first. They have all of the same needs, even the very profoundly handicapped children who live in the step group homes have emotions and feelings. They may be nonverbal. They may have very poor receptive language, meaning that if you tell them something, John, go pick up your clothes, you may get just a blank stare. I don't know, you know, in those situations whether he understood or is refusing. And they are excellent manipulators. Even the most profoundly handicapped child I have ever dealt with is a tremendous manipulator. They can read other people and they can manipulate other people's behavior. And if you think that's not true, I'll give you 1 week in our group homes to discover otherwise, because they will test new staff that come in. They will put down their feet about something, and absolutely, they have iron wills, you know, until they learn that you aren't going to give in any more than they are. They will push to the very limit until they learn with each individual who gives them care what those limits are. And I'm sure you find this in nursing care as well. To talk a little more about my personal experience, one of the things that we began to deal with and one of the things that caused our marriage to break down was the fact that there was no longer oneness between us. And I really believe that the MS, you know, it's not that probably we had a perfect marriage in the beginning, but my husband's MS created a situation with which we could no longer cope. We could no longer relate as a couple to one another. And certainly I believe that all of those things that led to our breaking apart were sin. You know, I think about the things that I can identify that created this situation for us that led to divorce, and probably the first one is fear. I think that I was afraid of having to take on roles that I really didn't want. I said I'm a Christian feminist, I truly believe that. But there was a part of me that wanted so desperately to be home taking care of our adopted child. And I didn't want to have to be the full-time breadwinner, and yet I was forced into that role. And certainly the Lord had prepared me well. I mean, I had all the appropriate degrees and I had experience and everything else, but I was fearful of having to assume that role and be a mother and wife and homemaker and do all of that and still be expected to do a good job at all of it. And his fear, I think, was fear of what he was becoming. He wanted to do what I was doing. He wanted to be in human services. He wanted to be in management and administration. And he had had those experiences, but as he became more and more disabled, that wasn't a possibility. And he didn't like himself for what he was becoming. He was fearful about what that made him. In some ways, I think that sexism in our society has created more boundaries for men almost than for women. There is such an expectation that this macho image and the be the breadwinner and all of those things, you know, I think women have almost found it easier to break out of that in some ways than men have. And the fact that he was the one that was becoming disabled destroyed his self-image and created a fear in him of being dependent, of not allowing people to give to him. He wanted to be doing the giving, and it was really destructive to his self-image to be in a position where he had to be accepting instead of giving. I think that those fears led to a great deal of anger. I think that he was angry at perhaps God, at any able-bodied person, including me, and it hurt. It hurt me, but it hurt him too, and I know it did. But he couldn't ever get past that. And I think he was angry because so many dreams that he had were shattered. was diagnosed as having MS at age 28. And the thing that I felt badly about, and you know, perhaps anger was even a part of that, was that my dreams were shattered too. I couldn't live out the life that I had thought in my mind, at least that was the role that I had grown up with. You know, that's the whole Cinderella myth or whatever, I guess, that young girls sort of are instilled with. But mostly I was angry because I couldn't reach him, and I think I lost the ability to cross the barrier. And we had really had a close and warm and loving relationship in the early part of our marriage. And I am so thankful for those years, because I think I have a feeling for what I think marriage should be, a marriage of equality and caring and sharing and becoming together. And maybe all of that is sort of a myth. Maybe none of that's really true. That's how I prefer to look at it, let's put it that way. And yet the fears that we experienced and the anger that he was dealing with, and in fact that the counselor could never help him get rid of, affected our relationship. And he would direct things at me that I could say intellectually, I know he doesn't mean this. I know that it's really just other things coming into play here. And yet it hurt so much that I began to not be able to let go of it. I was intellectualizing it, and I couldn't just say, you know, shut up, I can't stand this, you know, don't say that to me. I was constantly walking on eggshells, trying to make things okay. And I found that between my work, which was dealing with handicapped children and their parents and their fears and angers and guilt and frustration and everything all day long, and then coming home to it at night, I had just built up, you know, it just took all of my strength and energy to keep up the facades, to maintain the picture, and to keep trying to keep it together. And finally I realized I was destroying myself. I was destroying my ability to mother, to be a wife, to be a human being. I was feeling more and more just like an automaton, you know, just, is that the word I want? You know, a robot running around, somehow moving things and pushing papers and changing diapers and all of those things, but without any ability to feel anymore. And I felt so guilty, I think, about not being able to change things and not being able to trust the Lord enough to let go of it, you know. And I think, oh, you know, come on, God, where are those people with true faith? Why can't I be one of them? And I could sort of say, well, you know, I know that even the great theologians of the time doubted and that they didn't trust either. I couldn't cope with it any longer. The counselor that we went to was a Lutheran pastor who was in full-time counseling. He was wonderful. He helped me, I think, to see past my guilt, and he came to know us both well enough to know that at that point, David was not ready to let go of his anger. He was not ready to move back and turn it over and to turn his life over in a way that would allow him to feel some joy. And I think the whole thing for us was that growing sadness in our lives, that overall, where there had been joy and where there had been hope and everything else, all of that was just being replaced by a pervasive sadness. And when that happens, I think people become immobilized. They get to the point where they can no longer think logically. They can't function socially. They isolate themselves. And it's very easy to lose sight of the options then. And I could see that that was happening to me. I could see that it was affecting how I dealt with my daughter. I could see that it was affecting my relationships at work with my employees and with the people who were seeking help from us. And I finally made the decision that I had to go ahead with divorce because I felt it was the only solution left that was going to allow me to survive. I had even toyed with the thought of suicide, which for me was not in character at all. I've always been an extremely realistic person, but I've always been a Christian. At some points, my faith has been stronger than others. But I had never even contemplated such a thing before. And here I was, you know, thinking about it would sure be easier than trying to find a way out here. And at that point, I really knew that the decision would have to be to get out. And in a sense, there is a death in divorce. There is a, when they say the two become one, you truly become one. And the pulling apart is extremely painful. And yet it's really common. They say that among families where one individual has a mess, 95% of those families will end up divorced. I refused to believe that statistic when I first heard it. I rejected it. I said it won't happen to us. At that point, we were very close. And yet, now I understand why that happens. Among parents of handicapped children, I've heard the statistic 70% of parents of very severely handicapped children will end up divorced. And part of it is just the stress that a family goes through when there is a developmentally disabled or handicapped person who is a part of that family. And I certainly believe that, you know, the milder the handicap, the more like other families you are, and maybe the stresses related to that handicapped individual are less prominent, but there are still stresses, even with mild handicaps. You mentioned working with deaf individuals. I know Connie works with deaf individuals. One of the most isolating handicapping conditions is deafness. So much of our perception of the world and our ability to name and share thoughts and to communicate our humanness is tied up in language. And so not only does a deaf child, of course, not hear, they don't speak either. And so more than even blindness or anything else, I think the deaf tend to be isolated from the mainstream of society. And I'm real pleased that, like Sesame Street and some elementary schools now and everything, are teaching some sign and finger spelling and things like that just to create a channel of communication. I think that there are some very specific barriers that create problems for families that lead to those stresses. I think that one of them is the barrier of coming to grips with the death of a perfect individual. We never believe that our children or our grandchildren will be handicapped, that we will have a handicapped sister or brother. As we perceive world through our rose-colored glasses, we all think that our family will be immune from those things. I've learned a lot from my ex-husband. One of the things I think I have come to a deep appreciation for is the fact that we are all temporarily able-bodied. And having now watched a number of people who've been injured, like in car accidents or other kinds of disabling accidents, it can happen in a moment, in a second. We can all be one of that minority population. And in that sense, I think we need to be encompassing the shalom spirit that was mentioned this morning, a fullness of life for each of us will help be assured to us if we have created a kind of world in which there is an acceptance for deviancy, that we make accommodations for being different, and that we seek out ways to facilitate differences in the wide range of being human. And it's hard, I think, to be accommodating. We're all fairly well intact, and every person in them be perfect. I think that's probably what Hitler was setting out to do in part. And yet, the more deviancy or the more differences that we encompass, I think, the fuller our lives and the fuller our appreciation of humanness. We have a child in our group home. She came when she was like 7, and she's now 12. She sees and hears, but she does not have much mobility at all. In a wheelchair, she can use one hand a little bit to move herself. At age 12, we are just now beginning to toilet train her, and we are just beginning to get her to use a spoon at all. And what this has meant is that someone guides her from the elbow, or at this point it's the elbow, in the beginning it was from her hand, helps her grasp the spoon, a specially designed spoon, and pull it up this far. And all in the beginning she had to do was take the food off from the spoon, because all she wanted was pureed food, just sort of squirted into her mouth. We have come so far, and yet people look at her and they say, why are you investing this in this child? And it's expensive. Her services are not cheap. And yet, one of the things I can honestly say that Sarah has done is she's extremely responsive. And to every one of her caregivers over the years, there has been a bonding to her that probably it does not merit, you know, just on a face value, that bonding, because she is so incredibly handicapped. She doesn't communicate in any way. She has very few receptive language skills, mostly one-word commands, and that's about all, you know, probably only 4 or 5 commands that she can actually follow. And so, you know, you would think on that level then that she's not a very worthwhile member of our society. But because she is living in the community, there have been a number of people who have been touched by her and touched in sort of emotional ways that probably we couldn't appreciate through many other individuals that I know. And I think in that sense she's got some uniqueness that she has to offer to everyone. And she's taught me some things about being human. You know, she wants to be loved, and she communicates that in sort of specific ways. She screams, she goes, "Eek!" just at the top of her lungs, and that is her happy sign. And we've been so fearful all the time that someone accuses us of child abuse or something, because when she is really happy, she does that a lot. And it's taken us quite a while to be able to at least make the ease a little softer so that the people on the street don't get distressed by us. There is a grieving process, I think, that people go through that's another barrier. I talked about how people isolate themselves. Well, just as in the death of a loved one, that some of you may be familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's works, that I don't know that I buy into her, you know, specific little delineations of shock and denial and all of those things. But I think what happens with a handicapped child and their families, and for me as a handicapped spouse, is that you, maybe not shock, but I think the rest of the stages keep repeating themselves over and over again. And one of the things I've seen working with parents of handicapped children is that the first set of those stages, they'll begin at the first diagnosis, whenever that is, either at birth or later on if necessary. But then, in addition, they will occur like when the child enters their first program at school and the parent has to separate, and there's fear that, you know, these people won't take care of their child as well as they could, and that it happens again at each milestone in school or the first prom, when everybody else's child is getting ready to go to the prom. The mothers of those handicapped children grieve for the fact that their child is not having that experience. And one of the things that our Association for Retarded Citizens has done is to create separate experiences. They always have a winter formal in Billings. and they borrow dresses or they do whatever. And these are now adults, but they function at the level, you know, various levels, but some of them at the level of teenagers. And they have corsages, and they have a nice sit-down dinner, and they have a band come and play, and they love to dance. And so, you know, sometimes I think those experiences are as much for the parents as the children. It gives them a chance to have that normalcy to their child's life and to be able to offer that. And in that sense, I think it's almost therapeutic for them. I think that there are certain things that society can do to make the life of the disabled individual easier and to make it an experience that allows the family to cope a little better. I think that what is needed is a sense of relationships that allow all of the individuals to grow. And so within a family, if you can create relationships that allow not only the handicapped child, or in our case, the spouse to grow, but the caregiving members of that family to grow as well. And in the case of brothers and sisters, that allow the siblings to grow. One of the really detrimental effects of having a handicapped child is sometimes the fact that so much is invested in the handicapped child and the resources of the family, whether it's money resources to purchase medical care or time resources to do therapies or to take them to speech therapy and the audiologist and all of those other folks that always end up seeing handicapped individuals, that the siblings end up being somewhat neglected in the process. And frequently one thing that we see is if there's not good respite care available, many times the handicapped brothers and sisters will end up having to do a lot of babysitting. One of the things that people should really be aware of is that just because there's a handicapped individual in the family does not mean that the family is immune from other stresses. The families that we work with, frequently we come into contact with spouse abuse. Many of them are economically needy families that are just worrying about where the next meal is going to come from, let alone whether their child ought to be seeing the therapist this week. The other children can end up in the process having to do a lot of child care. They can end up being neglected, and they can end up having problems of their own. Sometimes I think that one of the causes that we see of children acting out in adolescence then is the fact that really they had a lot of responsibility when they were too young to really need that, I guess. And one of the things I think that as a society we need to do is we need to help families in ways that allow the other members of the family to grow. I think that's one of the things I felt was that as I felt more and more fearful of the burden that I was having to assume there, that I couldn't grow anymore. I could not grow in our marriage because I didn't have enough time, I didn't have enough space, I didn't have enough energy, I didn't have enough resources to be able to even put aside for a little while what was going on in that other part of my life. One of the things I mentioned is that I think that one of the needs is space, and I'm really pleased that we have come to the point where we can say we can do things without institutions. I get very frustrated because we are not at the point yet where we say that everybody deserves to live in the community, but we've come a lot farther there, and we're offering more of the varieties of living situations and work opportunities that I talked about earlier. But I think that there's a sense of a need for space for handicapped individuals. We see it with parents of autistic children, and for those of you who know anything about autism, it's a very debilitating handicap because the child, for whatever reason, walls themselves off from human contact. They enter a private little world where they may spin things or do whatever, but they refuse to interact on, you know, just even a physical level with their caregivers and things. And they have bizarre behaviors, terrible sleep disorders and things. And if there is a large enough space that the family lives in, that the family has a place to go and be alone and be away from this handicapped child for a while, that's one thing. But more and more we're seeing families who live in trailer homes or small apartments, and they don't have that opportunity to get away. Or even just in terms of, you think about how much space it takes to take and put in a wheelchair ramp. I have a friend right now who's having to move her family, and she has all these landlords who won't allow a wheelchair ramp to put in because it takes up too much space and it'll cover up the steps that are there, and they don't want that for their other tenants, and she's just facing all kinds of problems. So I think one of the things that we have to be able to accommodate is additional space for the handicapped. The other thing I think that we need to offer as a society is time for their families. And we see the need, and I felt the need desperately, for respite care. And what this means is usually individuals who volunteer or in some cases are paid. In our state it is truly minimal wage, not by any appropriate standards. It's like 94 cents an hour on the average. It's horrible. But it allows some, at least, babysitting pay for the parents of handicapped children to get away for a few hours or a few days or a few weeks, up to 3 weeks a year. And for some families, that's just not sufficient. But in my case, I needed that desperately. I needed time away. And yet to know that my husband was going to have someone sort of watching out for him, because at some points he couldn't even open the doorknob, and I was fearful, like if there were a fire or something, he couldn't get out. And there was no respite care because he didn't have the right definition of disability to qualify for that service in our state. And I was talking to someone yesterday from California saying the same thing, that they were looking for respite care for a family with someone that had that need, and it's just not available. And I think as Christians, probably that's one thing that we could offer to families of the handicapped, because it really doesn't take a lot, but be willing to provide respite care, to take them places, as you pointed out earlier, or to just go to their home and be with them, to give the family some time to have, in our case, the handicapped child removed from some family activities so parents can get to know their children again, or brothers and sisters can get to know each other, or for the marriage to kind of regenerate. And it's a critical service. In fact, we did a study in Montana, and the number one need mentioned by parents who had previously institutionalized their child was that they needed time away, they needed respite care, they needed time for themselves that they could never get in the system as it existed previously. I guess what I'm asking for the handicapped is, in addition to acceptance, that we create choices for them. Jim tells me that he lives in an apartment all of his own, does all of his own work. He has, I don't know what the name of this is, but I'll call it an Amigo. It's like a little golf cart thing that he gets around town with. We need, in our city, better mass transit kinds of things for the handicapped, and I know that some of what's going on is making that possible in terms of policy setting at the national and state levels. I worked on a committee last year called Priorities for People in Montana, and it was a experimental grassroots effort to develop our state budget for the dependent populations in our state. There were 24 individuals. We worked in four teams of six people each. They represented seniors, disabled, economically needy, and youth and children. And so we were dealing with everything from assuring that there were sufficient caseworkers in Montana to deal with child abuse complaints, to programs similar to ours to develop alternatives to nursing homes for senior citizens. We worked on all kinds of projects, including our welfare budget, which it never ceases to amaze me how much our Medicaid program on our aid to families with dependent children costs us. And yet, you know, one of the things that I have come to realize, I've also worked 3 terms now lobbying for the disabled in our state legislature. And through all of those experiences, I was motivated in part by my personal need, I think, to do something about the guilt I had about not being able to cope with my marriage and to preserve my marriage in spite of my husband's handicap. But I was also motivated by the needs that I see for parents who talk to me and cry in my office and have no place to turn because their child is 25th on a waiting list and there are only 2 turnovers expected for that service in the next year or something. And I could see where we were taking resources that seemed to me to be frivolous and not particularly productive in terms of producing a better society. We were investing them there when we had so many needy people who couldn't speak for themselves that we could be taking those same resources and doing something really good, I felt, for all Montanans. It's been a frustrating experience, and we did yet very well. We have gotten some expansion of services. I am pleased that I've had the opportunity to do that. I know I also will not quit there. I will continue to be an advocate for the handicapped. I will continue to train parents to be advocates. But I also know that I have to deal with things too on a personal level, and I will continue to work with my ex-husband just as we raise our child in separate families, and with the friends that I have who have handicapped individuals living with them. I hope the ideas that I've shared with you today help. I want to leave with you one verse. It's from Isaiah 12:2-6. That sustained me through making the decision to divorce, and it's just been something that I've grasped and held so tightly, but it really meant something to me. It's Isaiah 12:2-6. Surely it is God who saves me. I will trust in him and not be afraid, for he is my stronghold and my sure defense, and he will be my savior. Thank you.